Welcome to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
And the main reason, in fact, why I've turned to the book of Revelation is it seems to me to be a perfect example of a book that can make, that tries to make history disappear. It's a book that talks about the end of history and tries to present its kind of authority as that which exists beyond history, that transcends history. And so a great part of the motive in my work was to go back and to show that that beyond history quality, transcendent quality, in fact, functioned very much for historical, political, and social purposes, just as I think aesthetic standards, which are supposed to be apart from all political interests, in fact, I think function to
advance. In an allegory. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things allegorical poets will do is create a narrative that is incoherent on its literal level, so that things will not hang together. You can't see a connection between one event and another.
And this is why undergraduates have a tough time with things like the Fairy Queen, for instance.
Well, I don't know. My undergraduates always expect to have a tough time with it, but they always are surprised at how much they enjoy the poem.
Uh-huh.
I don't think they have as soon as you tell them that it's a lot like a video game or that they read the Fairy Queen because they didn't have video games in Scientific American, they seem to catch on. I've also found approaches to the Fairy Queen that take in things like information theory, with which undergraduates are very familiar. Mm-hmm. They find fascinating.
If one allegory and apocalypse, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for two conversations about English literary culture. You'll hear from Gordon Teske of Cornell University and from Stephen Goldsmith of the University of California at Berkeley. First, Stephen Goldsmith discusses the representation of apocalypse in the literature of English Romanticism. Following that, Gordon Teske will talk about allegory from antiquity to the time of the Enlightenment. The word apocalypse denotes the prophetic revelations found in the last book of the New Testament. Since the late 18th century, writers and artists have employed apocalypse as a central category of modern aesthetics. But according to Stephen Goldsmith, one question must always be posed about apocalyptic art. Namely, what political function does apocalypse serve when it represents the end of history? Stephen Goldsmith.
Well, the place that I always begin is with the book of Revelation itself. Uh-huh. And I use this as a kind of test case for this sort of authority. One of the arguments that concerns me most is that the book of Revelation commands its special authority precisely because it claims to have its origins outside of history. It claims to derive from a source that transcends the historical moment and therefore can function as an authority for all historical moments.
Yeah,
I think that is central to almost any definition of canon.
That's in part
why the Book of Revelation itself became such a crucial text in the Christian canon, the one that actually closes the New Testament, closes the entire Bible.
Well, let's focus on that for a moment, Steve Goldsmith. You have John the Revelator on the Isle of Patmos, what is it, something like 40 years after the death of Christ, and he has this vision of the way the world will end. Is it solely about the end of the world? What else goes on in this revelation of John on the Isle of Patmos?
Okay, sure. There are several things going on simultaneously. On the one hand, it is a vision of the end of the world, and I would never question the idea that John believed that the end was imminent, that Christ was about to return, and that this was sufficient to encourage Christians to maintain their faith in the face of persecution. You said 40 years or so after his death. A little bit later than that. We don't know exactly the date, but we think it would be roughly around 94 or 95.
I see. Okay.
And his vision is meant to encourage Christians to abide by the faith. At the same time, though, the book is written under unusual circumstances. There's always the external pressure, the Roman Empire, compulsory emperor worship. Christians, of course, could be persecuted. They could be put to death if they were not willing to worship the emperor. And it is in that situation that John writes his book and imagines Christ returning as a conquering soldier, as a conquering hero, mm-hmm. who will overthrow the evil empire, overthrow Rome, and allow Christians to ascend into this millennial kingdom. But at the same time as it's written against that kind of external persecution, there's another factor pressuring John's text, and that there are rival interpretations of Christianity at that time. There are competing visions of what Christians should do.
And he's speaking for one of these.
And he is speaking, precisely, he is speaking for one of these. For instance, some of the early Christians, now the documentation for this is sketchy. It has to be reconstructed. But there is some evidence that there were early Christians who believed that there should be some accommodation with the Roman Empire, that one could make compromises. John was strictly against such compromises.
Render unto Caesar, that kind of thing?
Exactly, render unto Caesar. And much of it had to do with, most specifically, with whether Christians could eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. John believed that this was absolutely forbidden. But there were rival teachers, rival preachers in a Christian community that you have to understand was not institutionally fixed and was not centralized at this early stage.
All right, so it isn't necessarily disrespectful to Christianity as an institution or to John on the Isle of Patmos to say that here we have really a political document, and that carries forward into our secular literary history. That becomes a kind of an organizing principle by which we honor or exclude various kinds of literary expression.
Right. To put it most simply, I would suggest that it is always certainly the case that there will continue to be fundamentalists who take the Book of Revelation and all of the prophecies literally. Mm-hmm. Prophecies are never wrong. Interpreters only are wrong.
By nature, that means, they cannot be.
That means that the same prophecies, precisely because they are so very vague and so symbolically rich and so indeterminate, that they can be endlessly reinterpreted, and this will go on forever. And there will always be those who see any situation in which a bomb goes off in the Middle East as a sign of the end. And I don't mean to minimize the size of this group. They're formidable. The book that is hottest on the shelves right now in Bible bookstores is this Armageddon. Armageddon oil in the Middle East crisis, which when they reprinted in a million copies. We're not talking about a small group of people. On the other hand, that is a minority phenomenon. It's the minority phenomenon of fundamentalism. On the other hand, what I'm dealing with is the way in which apocalypse has infiltrated the more general concerns of Western culture, and the way in which it's entered into the secular consciousness, mainly in terms of ideas about art, ideas about books, ideas about literature.
All right, now be specific for me.
Sure.
Hang that on a peg for me.
It is the tendency to see these things as in their essence existing apart from historical contingencies. This is what we mean when we say, when it has traditionally been claimed of canonical literature, that they are timeless, that they will appeal to all generations because they in themselves exist apart from history.
What about the argument, Steve Goldsmith, that history has ended, that there is no more history? I cannot remember the professor or the gentleman's name, but there was a piece that caused some stir in the academic circles a year or so ago about how we don't need to worry about history anymore because history is, the scroll is unraveled, it's all over with. How do you come at that from this notion of canon and apocalypse?
Glad you brought that up, Wade. This was a piece by Fukuyama, I think, that you're referring to that was called The End of History with a question mark. Uh-huh. It's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Obviously, it invokes apocalyptic rhetoric, not of the same sort of Christian fundamentalism, but of a secular sort that argues that history progresses toward an end, toward a telos. In that piece, it happens that the telos is Western liberal capitalist democracy. The argument there is that we have achieved the final state of human society, at least in terms of the idea that needs to be achieved.
That's pretty arrogant, isn't it? I mean, that triumphalism, that, you know, we're at the top of the heap.
It's not just
aren't going to get any better than the way we've made them, huh?
It's not just arrogant. It's politically serviceable. If one, in fact, can create the idea that one's society, essentially as it exists, is the end of history, one has ruled out the possibility of all conflict and all change.
So what does apocalypse do to that notion? What you're saying is that's not only arrogant and rude, that is just flatly wrong to say that history has ended, right?
I'm saying it's absolutely typical of the apocalyptic tradition, which is to be able to command a certain political authority by claiming that one speaks from a position, from an idea, from an existence already beyond history.
That cannot be argued against.
History has changed, right? Apocalypse is to argue that... apocalypse is to present oneself as already existing beyond change.
All right, now
making oneself invulnerable to change.
Steve Goldsmith, where is your line of authority? If we shouldn't look to the unraveling of the scroll of history, if we shouldn't look to the model of apocalypse for arguments that take us beyond history, where do you stand? I mean, is there quicksand underneath you? What is this authority that you're looking for?
I guess the question gives me some problems because I don't see myself as looking for authority.
You want to abolish that notion altogether.
Yeah, right, exactly. I want to abolish the notion of an ahistorical authority.
Isn't that a dangerous thing to do with regard, for example, to our educational standards, much less these far grander, more abstract notions of what history is and where it heads and how it serves us?
I don't think so. I think the best thing that you can possibly do for students is to teach them how to see authority. It's a difficult thing to see. It passes invisibly. It can appear just in the beauty of a text, for instance.
You don't feel threatened as a professor when you walk into the classroom and say, all right, kids, you're going to read this, 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 and this, and somebody on the front row stands up and says, wait a minute, I don't buy that. I'm not sure exactly what your basis is for picking that particular text, but I don't have to read that. Here's another one that I'm going to read. Now, am I exaggerating a situation here that may or may not occur in your classes?
You could certainly imagine a student like that becoming a nightmare. On the other hand, in most cases, that's exactly the kind of student that you pray for.
Uh-huh.
You want students to come out and to challenge your authority. I mean, this has to be a principle that's then transferred to almost every level of a classroom. You want to teach students how to read antithetically, meaning that you don't want them to passively absorb the text self-representation.
You're telling me that as we go back and look at these poets here, Steve Goldsmith, you're writing about William Blake, for instance, that we don't necessarily see them as reservoirs of peace and harmony and comforting ourselves about our Western inheritance. Really, you're saying that these are subversive figures, that if we read them carefully and deliberately, they're going to rock the boat. They're not going to contribute to this notion of cultural stability, our Western inheritance. Right?
You don't even have to read Blake carefully to see that.
Yeah, just reading.
It's on the surface. I mean, Blake, one of Blake's great aphorisms was opposition is true friendship. Blake believed in the health of conflict, difference, opposition. If Blake were a literary critic today, he would put critical back into the term criticism.
Stephen Goldsmith teaches at the University of California at Berkeley. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Goldsmith worked on a study of apocalypse in the literature of English Romanticism. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on English literary culture continues. You'll hear next from Gordon Teske, a professor of English at Cornell University. During his recent fellowship year at the center, Gordon Teske worked on a study of allegory from antiquity to the time of the Enlightenment, with special attention to the ways in which allegorical writing evokes interpretive responses and aesthetic effects. Teske also examined the means by which artists like Homer, Dante, and Spenser have used allegory to represent the difference between the self and the world that surrounds it. Gordon Teske.
Well,
Poetics can be distinguished from hermeneutics or interpretation. Most of the critical practices that are in play at the moment are forms of interpretation, ways of finding meanings in texts or of discussing the problems of finding meanings
in texts. You're talking about things like structuralism and deconstruction and all
I don't want to attach names to them because some of these fields are bifurcated. A lot of structuralism is involved with poetics, for instance. Mm-hmm. I just want to say that one way of looking at all critical procedures is to say that either they interpret texts or they talk about how they work.
Fair enough.
And they either ask, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. Or how can I tell if this means anything? Or else they ask, how does this work?
All right.
Kinds of technical procedures is the writer using?
And which of these fields are you standing in? How are you addressing this problem? Are you in the first, the second, or both?
The second. That is, I'm more interested in, so far as allegory is concerned, not with what these things mean, but with how they work, what kinds of effects an author is trying to elicit, and what means that author is using.
All right, well, let's pause on that. Give me a very concrete example, if you will, Gordon Teske, of an effect that an author intends and how that writer brings it to fruition.
In an allegory?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the things allegorical poets will do is create a narrative that is incoherent on its literal level so that things will not hang together. You can't see a connection between one event and another.
And this is why undergraduates have a tough time with things like The Faerie Queene, for instance.
Well, I don't know. My undergraduates always expect to have a tough time with it, but they always are surprised at how much they enjoy the poem.
Uh-huh.
I don't think they have as soon as you tell them that it's a lot like a video game or that they read The Faerie Queene because they didn't have video games in Scientific American, they seem to catch on. I've also found approaches to The Faerie Queene that take in things like information theory, with which undergraduates are very familiar, they find fascinating. If one approaches The Faerie Queene through Christian humanism and traditional iconography and the sorts of approaches in which most of us were trained, one faces some fairly glassy stares. But I think that The Faerie Queene is really about things that are more profound than that those are really superficial aspects of The Faerie Queene.
All right, well, let's get back to this business of what appears to be confusing and difficult and not making sense. And yet your argument is that allegory as a rhetorical device undercuts that there is a unity, that there is a meaning or an accessibility. Are we on the right track?
We're on the right track because there is the illusion of meaning. One of the ways I would, one of the quick definitions I have of allegory is that it's an incoherent narrative that makes us interpret throughout.
Uh-huh. That sounds like the definition of a novel. It's long, it's difficult, and there's something wrong with it.
Perhaps, except novels are at least superficially coherent in the sense that when you read a novel, you are constantly putting together, even when you read a sentence, your mind is at some level constantly making the words fit together. You're performing some sort of operation. That is, unless you had some form of dyslexia in which you could only see each word and not connect it to each other, you are performing these unconscious processes of unifying what you read.
All right, so, and in the instance of allegory, what's going on?
Just to complete the point about the novel, in the novel, this process goes unconsciously, whereas in allegory, you're forced to unify the work consciously.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you are forced to unify it by means of interpretation. You are forced to say, what does this mean? What is the connection between this event and another?
Does that mean, Gordon, that you read it word for word at that what speed or level? Whereas in the case of a novel, your eyes scan the page rather quickly, and as you say, a lot of this coherence is unconscious on the part of the reader. And with allegory,
well, it is true that one must read an allegory with much closer is immediately aware of having to read it with much closer attention to words. And in fact, in the work of Maureen Quilligan, a great deal of attention has quite properly been brought to this aspect of allegory, its polysemous density at the level of language.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm more centrally interested in, though I think this is the linguistic aspect of is part of it, is the way episodes don't hang together. Let me give an example from The Faerie Queene. There's an episode very early on in The Faerie Queene when the Red Cross Knight has been deceived by Archimago into thinking that the lady he's with, whose name is Una, oneness or truth, has been behaving rather badly, and so he gets up and leaves. And the first person he encounters after he's left Una is a knight by the name of Sans Foy, translated means literally without faith, mm-hmm. and has a big fight with Sans Foy. Now, this episodic and accidental character of allegorical narrative is extremely typical, and the only way you can make any kind of narrative connection that makes sense, apart from the pure accident of running into someone, is by interpreting the sequence of episodes and saying that a man who loses his faith will encounter the dangers that are attendant upon loss of faith or sense.
In other words, Gordon, the structure reinforces the substance. There is a paradox here between the loss of faith, the loss of meaning, the finding of faith, the finding of meaning, that sort of thing. I don't want to take you off the track, but you could be talking about the theater of the absurd. We go in and we sit down and we look at something that just doesn't make sense, and then we have to force ourselves to think it through to find some sense there. Are we on the right track again?
Well, yes, because you've put your finger on really what got me interested in allegory from the beginning. That is, I was interested in Dadaist and absurdist art, and mm-hmm. when I first began reading allegories, and indeed the reason I fell in love with the Fairy Queen was because I found it so funny, and so much.
Not a typical reaction necessarily.
No, not I suppose a typical one, but it really is a very funny poem, especially if you're used to absurdist art, Dadaist art, and, uh-huh. and many of the assumptions of modern art and literature, which emphasize discontinuity, rapid violent juxtaposition, the tearing of things out of previous contexts and putting uh-huh. them together in new and surprising ways.
All right, now Gordon, you just used the word the words modern literature. My sense is that although allegory has a long and an honorable tradition among you literary historians, it is not something that is at the fore in the doing of literature, the writing, the consumption of literature here in the end of the 20th century. As you look around popular culture, literary culture, here again in the 1990s, do you find analogs, manifestations of allegory? Let me load the question. I'm thinking of Andy Warhol's cans of Campbell's soup. Does that at all connect with your interest as a scholar of literary allegory?
Let me put it this way, that I'm fascinated with modern art, and that it informs my attempts to understand allegory, so that the process of explanation for me is working backwards. I use modern art as a way of exploring. I use it as instruments for exploring and opening up works of the past, rather than the other way around. I don't use allegories to understand Andy Warhol. I'm fascinated with Warhol's work, especially the explosive violence in Warhol's work, in his films, in the late works like Saturday Night Massacre and so forth. And mm-hmm. these, believe it or not, these works have considerable interest for me in looking back at allegory, particularly questions and problems of violence in allegory. Mm-hmm. A couple of modern figures have been important to me then. I wouldn't say that Warhol's been important in that way, though he's a powerful example. Is Walter Benjamin, who's one of the most influential of modern critics and a highly eccentric one, and who wrote highly eccentric and what I think is really profound and central discussion of allegory in his book on German tragic drama. And thinking through issues of violence and what Benjamin has to say about allegory as a kind of tearing apart and putting together again, by analogy to collage, I've been interested in taking those sorts of questions and using them to look back into allegorical works of the past. There's been a tendency to look at that historical period of allegory with which I'm interested and see it as a great and harmonious period in which everything in the world fit in with everything else.
But that's not necessarily the case.
That's not at all the way I'm interested in looking at it. In other words, that C.S. Lewis talked about Spencer's images of life. And allegory seemed to be life-affirming and world-affirming, talking about the unity of everything in the cosmos in one great system of meaning. Benjamin talked about allegory in terms of death, violence, tearing. He said that the basis of signification in allegory is in the fact that it is constantly the work of death. For death, as he says, etches most deeply the jagged line between nature and meaning. If one assumes that the whole world is a system of signs that ultimately refer back to that initial word, then within such a metaphysical belief about the structure of the world, it would be not surprising that a literary form would develop in which one can suppose that everything that seems incoherent on the surface of the work mm-hmm. points inward to what I call its singularity. That is a point of fundamental meaning that holds everything in the work together.
In other words, finding meaning or order when there is not necessarily meaning or order to be found.
That's right. And finding meaning and order on the terms that an allegory forces one to presuppose so that such meaning and order will appear. And I'm more interested in how allegory creates the illusion of meaning and order in itself, of a structure of meaning that is being raised up from the sequential unfolding of its text, a structure of meaning that finally points into this singularity of an absolute meaning that enfolds everything into itself. And as soon as one begins interpreting an allegory, one can become drawn into this structure of assumptions. So for the moment, I'm interested in standing outside it and talking about how an allegory produces aesthetic effects.
Does that mean, Gordon, to put a very large word on the table here, that you don't believe in things like truth? That allegory can lead us to political or aesthetic or cultural truths, that we have to keep stripping away these assumptions of order and meaning?
I think that allegory has created one of the more powerful illusions of truth that we've had, and that it's fascinating for that reason.
Gordon Teske teaches at Cornell University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Gordon Teske worked on a study of allegory from antiquity into the modern world. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Allegory and Apocalypse is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 566. That's program number 566. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, the topic will be Peaceable Kingdoms. Wayne Pond will talk with Joseph Gerson and Carol Adams. Joseph Gerson is Peace Education Secretary for the American Friends Service Committee. Gerson will discuss his new book, The Sun Never Sets, Confronting the Network of Foreign U.S. Military Bases. Carol Adams is an independent scholar. She'll discuss her new book, a volume entitled The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist-Vegetarian Critical Theory. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Allegory and Apocalypse, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Stephen Goldsmith of the University of California at Berkeley discusses the representation of apocalypse in the literature of English Romanticism. Gordon Teske of Cornell University talks about allegory from antiquity to the Enlightenment. Allegory and Apocalypse, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.